Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. If you have been wondering when and how you might be able to take advantage of some of the massive pile of federal dollars that will be spent in the coming years on decarbonizing our economy, we may have some answers for you on today's show. We will be talking about the so-called Inflation Reduction Act's climate provisions with Sam Ricketts. He is the co-founder of Evergreen Action, which is an environmental advocacy group. But first, a couple of items you may have missed. There was a lawsuit filed last November that I've just heard about this week. And it's one that we should all keep an eye on. The American Prospect reported on it this week. That's where I caught up on it. It's called Municipalities of Puerto Rico versus ExxonMobil Corp. et al. And it has the potential to be a really groundbreaking action. And let me just quote the American Prospect piece. It's by Ramenda Cyrus. 16 Puerto Rican municipalities have filed a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against some of the largest oil companies in the world, including ExxonMobil and Shell. The municipalities have accused more than 10 oil companies of a coordinated disinformation campaign that amounts to a violation of the United States Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, that's RICO. The suit truly is one of a kind. It builds on the experience of decades of climate litigation, facing the legal trickery that fossil fuel companies have used to delay justice indefinitely. As a result, says Ramenda Cyrus, the suit will likely force the companies to actually answer for their actions and defend themselves. Now, the plaintiffs are asking for decades of damages, including for the death and destruction from Hurricane Maria, which devastated Puerto Rico in 2017. This is the flip side of a more pernicious trend that we've seen with fossil fuel companies using their deep pockets to litigate against efforts to decarbonize our economy. Last month, the New York Times reported that a group called the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which is just a front group, is a right-wing front group for fossil fuel companies, they are suing to block wind projects and other renewable energy projects, and they're doing so somewhat covertly. For example, they're backing other groups of stakeholders, in one case a group of fishermen, to obscure big oil's involvement in this litigation. By the way, I always wonder if the people working in these like right-wing shops have kids, or like if they do have kids, do they not like them? Like, just, I don't know. I don't get it. Speaking of litigation, a drug company and a North Carolina physician are suing the state of North Carolina separately, two different filings. After the Republican legislature enacted a bunch of medically unnecessary restrictions on the abortion drug mifepristone, the crux of the complaint is that the federal government has the power to regulate pharmaceutical sales, and the state, you know, the Constitution's Supremacy Clause says that federal laws supersede state laws when they're in conflict. And the reason to watch this case is that it will likely set a precedent. The anti-choice movement is trying to figure out how to come after medical abortions, which are harder for them to ban than surgical abortions. Let's see. I'm recording this on the 26th day of the year. America has already experienced 40 mass shootings. Like 40 mass shootings in 26 days. There are a couple of criminologists, Jillian Peterson and James Densley. They're both, you know, professors. They had an interesting piece in the New York Times. And they looked at like 50 mass shootings in the past couple of years. And they say that what is driving it is, well, let me quote it. They write, the killings are not just random acts of violence, but rather a symptom of a deeper societal problem the continued rise of deaths of despair. So these scholars note that the perpetrators are all almost all men. They don't add that most of them were white, but we know that from the data. They continue, and I quote, "This term," and here they're referencing the term deaths of despair, "this term has been used to explain increasing mortality rates among predominantly middle-aged white men caused by suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol abuse." So they're saying this was, they're taking this term and they're attributing to these shootings to this as well. They add, many of the perpetrators, many were socially isolated from their families or their communities and felt a sense of alienation. Now, I should say this is a good piece, but the researchers do not mention guns. They just don't mention the massive number of guns in this country, which is odd because other countries, one assumes, suffer, you know, have people suffering from social isolation, a sense of alienation, and they don't have an average of more than a mass murder every day. And one of the things that makes us unique is that we have more firearms in private hands than we have people, right? There are more privately owned guns in the U.S. than there are people. And the data are very clear that the more guns a state or a country has, the more gun crimes they have, including mass shootings. Most gun crimes are not mass shootings, but that includes mass shootings. There is another thing, however, that makes America unique, or at least somewhat unique. This week, the Secret Service released a report analyzing 173 attacks that hurt three or more people in public spaces, including churches and schools, from 2016 to 2020. And I should just note, if you care about these details, like the mass shootings are defined by four or more. And this is looking at attacks that are not only with guns and that hurt three or more people in public spaces. Anyway, let me quote a write-up about this report from NBC. They report that, quote, "Although a personal grievance of some sort was the single most common motive, one quarter of the attackers studied from 2016 to 2020 were motivated by conspiracy theories or hateful ideologies, which included anti-government, anti-Semitic, or misogynistic views." And the reason I think this is really important to point out, again, so the majority are not actually driven by ideology. People are frustrated. They have problems. They take it out on society. But a quarter is a significant number. And the political scientist Brian Klass had a piece that I thought was refreshing in The Atlantic last week. He talked about polarization, which is often bandied about as the source of our political woes. And he said that the U.S. isn't the only country with serious polarization. But he then wrote, and I quote, "The problems in American democracy are worse. That's because a particularly insidious disease has infected the core of its political system, one that is not present to the same degree in other rich democracies, extreme conspiracism. Other countries, including the UK, have polarization. America has irrational polarization in which one political party, has fallen under the spell of conspiratorial thinking. Polarization plus this conspiracist tendency risks turning run-of-the-mill democratic dysfunction into a democratic death spiral. The battle for American democracy will be over reality." He gives a lot of examples of this. And he says very clearly, this is an asymmetric thing. It's within the modern GOP. He says that conspiracy theories have replaced policy ideas. And it was refreshing because of that, right? He didn't try to both sides this. And a lot of people are shy about stating something that I think is a pretty obvious but a really alarming fact, which is that the American right is relentless in its embrace of guns and of conspiracy theories, and mainstream figures, including elected Republicans, constantly are pushing out the idea that shady, malign forces, often tinged with like racial grievance, are arrayed against Americans, the real Americans, heartland Americans. And if you look at this, these two kind of twin causes, flood of guns, ton of conspiracy theories, and also social isolation and all of that, you have to think at some point that mass shootings are a right-wing policy choice. And the frequency of those mass shootings then motivates more people to want to carry guns. It's just a vicious cycle. So we're in dangerous waters for sure. And with that, let's move on to something more positive, because we do have a pretty positive show this week. We'll take a quick break and then come right back with Sam Ricketts to talk about a potentially transformative effort to save the climate. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You know, I do not want Democrats to emulate Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies, his weaponization of law enforcement. I don't want them to emulate the clownish tweets. I do sometimes wish they were just a little bit more like him in terms of touting their achievements, in terms of taking credit for their real achievements, as he did constantly with his often imaginary ones. And that's not just a dig on Democrats, by the way. They don't have the same media infrastructure that Republicans enjoy, Fox News, whatever. But it really bothers me that we hear very little about the Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, despite the fact that it has the potential to be a game-changing bill in the fight against catastrophic climate change, restructuring of the economy. It's a big deal, but it's a policy story, right? And that isn't sexy. And we'll talk a little bit about how it is being covered to the extent that it is getting coverage. And, you know, obviously we don't have the kind of platform that, you know, say Tucker Carlson has to stoke moral panics about unsexy candy or Mr. Potato Head. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you're lucky. But we're going to do our part to tell you about this historic piece of legislation. We've covered this before. We're going to keep covering it. And to help us with that, we're joined now by Sam Ricketts. Sam is a co-founder of and senior advisor to the advocacy group Evergreen Action. Sam, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time. So when the IRA first passed, we had David Roberts on the show to talk about it. He was typically nuanced in his take that it was both insufficient given the scope of the crisis and also a potentially paradigm-changing bill that might help us avert the worst impacts of climate change. And central to that kind of take, one of the points he made to that effect is that these very significant clean energy subsidies in the IRA, both on the consumer side and the manufacturer side, would hopefully start a race to the top with other advanced countries trying to match the US, right? So competition, in his view, and on this issue, is good, which seems to make sense to me as a person who enjoys living on a habitable planet. So that appears to be happening. Let me quote a report just last week from the Financial Times. The EU is preparing to take on President Joe Biden's showpiece legislation, which has turbocharged green investment in the U.S. by loosening restrictions on subsidies in Europe and accelerating permits for new projects. Ursula von der Leyen, and for listeners who aren't familiar with that name, she's the current president of the EU Commission. Ursula von der Leyen told chief executives of World Economic Forum in Davos that Brussels would temporarily water down state aid regulations and pump cash into strategic climate-friendly businesses as it sought to counter Biden's $369 billion green subsidy package. So this seems very good. I wonder what your take is on this question of whether the IRA is having a multiplier effect internationally. And there's also been some coverage about how this may be leading to a new trade war. Is a trade war a bad thing when you're talking about a competition to decarbonize your economy?
Thank you. It's a wonderful question. Wonderful. first of all,
sorry for the long-winded question. I had to amp up to that.
These are the right questions. These are the questions of the day. These are verily the questions of the century. Quite literally speaking, for all 7 billion of us, right? First things first, the Inflation Reduction Act is an utterly game-changing piece of legislation passed by Congress and signed by President Biden last summer, investing nearly $400 billion of projected monies, perhaps much, much more. That's just a projection based on what CBO, Congressional Budget Office, the Joint Committee on Taxation inside of Congress, just projected on what they think is going to result in uptake of these tax credits and people buying these appliances, consumers investing in advanced manufacturing. Could actually be much more than that. Projections out there that really there could be as much as $500 billion, $800 billion, $1 trillion worth of public investment flowing through the tax code and through these federal financing and grant programs into building the clean energy economy, which is just a scale of investment into climate solutions we've never, ever had before in this country. This is a game changer. And first of all, just to hit on the point, there's tax credits in this package. The bulk of the money flows through the tax code, sort of spending in reverse,
yes,
that are going to be available to consumers, individually, to homeowners, drivers, you know, individual consumers to electrify, to clean up, to get better, cheaper, more affordable, I should say.
Yes.
And more energy efficient things that will actually cut their costs, will create good jobs too. There's also tax incentives for businesses to make investments in the American economy, right? Like massive investments that are already drawing in, you know, tens of billions of dollars worth of investments in advanced battery manufacturing facilities, solar manufacturing, again, growing in the United States, that kind of thing. And then also newly incentives that are available for nonprofit utilities, nonprofit organizations to take advantage of federal co-investment in building sustainability solutions, clean energy projects, climate solutions throughout the country. It's just a game changer. And it's a game changer with the tax code. There's a range of programs at different federal agencies, EPA, Department of Energy, Departments of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, that are all going to be about also, you know, using more directed financing and grant dollars in communities ranging from rural to urban, from red to blue to purple states that are going to be about building a clean energy future for the country. It's all very exciting. And now the ballgame is implementation on making sure that all goes well. Let me come to your global question though, that really the way you started with, which I think is really the way I think about it is this: the United States has not been in the game in the way that it needs to with concerted industrial policy and major investment like we're getting now from the IRA on the global race for clean energy. This is going to be the industries, as we know, we need to take on climate change, as countries are increasingly doing so. The United States was doing it a little bit. Now it's doing it more bigly, to quote somebody, yes, that we won't name. But other countries had been moving forward here, right? The Chinese government has been investing in building the clean energy future. It knows the future of transportation is electric vehicles. It's trying to dominate the global electric vehicle market. Europe has been leading in development of wind energy technology, of solar energy technology, of electric vehicles as well. These, you know, other parts of the country, many of our trading partners are our economic partners, sometimes our economic rivals, have recognized the future is in clean energy, and they have been making steps forward. The IRA is the United States, finally, at long last, after too long, getting in the game. And sure, that will be received by some of these overseas partners, even our allies, as, hey, this is our domain, or why are you doing this, or why are you putting restrictions on which cars we can sell to you when you want to build those industries yourself?
Yes.
That's going to be kind of natural. And that's going to happen. It's going to, there'll be imbalance invites itself here, but that's okay. This is all about everyone needing to level up here. The United States getting on the playing field with this bold investment. I think you're seeing, in addition to some complaints you're seeing from partners like in Europe, like you referenced, you're also seeing them with the other hand say, well, time to go build our own.
We got to do this as well.
Right. So, this is the kind of friendly competition, a rising tide lifting all boats that more countries are going to need to see. And hopefully this is just an action as a domino, that the United States taking this action with the IRA, with the Inflation Reduction Act, leads to many more nations also up in their ambition when it comes to investing in the climate solutions that we're all going to need, both for a better economy, for greater public health, but also for a livable future.
You know, so many of the critics of the neoliberal trade regime have said that it's a race to the bottom. And here we have sort of a race to the top. I just want to point out how some of the so-called liberal media are covering this. The New York Times had a headline this week: "Climate change may usher in a new era of trade wars." That's how they're taking. Washington Post said, "Why Europe is fuming over America's green subsidies." And I wonder if the kind of hits that the free traders have taken over many years across the political spectrum is creating some political space that allows us to say, hey, listen, we are subsidizing these industries because actually that's something that we need to do. It is an industrial policy as well as a climate policy. I invited you to talk about primarily what kind of consumer subsidies listeners might take advantage of to smallify their own carbon footprints. But I have one more big picture question. Political reports that, and I quote, GOP lawmakers voted en masse against Biden's signature bill, but roughly two-thirds of green energy projects announced since it became law are going to Republican-held congressional districts. You had mentioned it's going to green, blue states and red states and purple states. Sam, is that by design to get Republican buy-in, or is that just kind of a coincidence, given that they're going, to projects in, say, rural areas that tend to be overrepresented by Republicans?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And it's a mix. Can I start by hitting on one thing? Because you just referenced it. You know, for a long time that it was thought that the path forward towards climate solutions or sustainability was just slapping a price or a penalty on pollution. And certainly that's part of the ball game.
Yes.
But really what the IRA shows now is really the marriage of industrial policy and realizing and investing in a better economy with climate solutions, right? This is no longer just an investment about making pollution cost more. This is an investment in creating jobs, creating better environmental justice, more equitable economic outcomes, and building the future that we want together, and using public money to do it in a way that the country has done in the past when it comes to big projects, right? When it comes to the New Deal, when it comes to the Great Society, when it comes to major infrastructure investment that we need. It's a return to roots of sorts. It's also a new paradigm of sorts, particularly for an environmental movement that's been largely about stopping pollution, stopping bad things for the last 4, 5, or 6 decades.
You know, let me interject something. We're going to get back to the projects that are in these red states. This is something that has been a promise or a political argument since as long as I can remember, since the early aughts at least. You know, they called it the Green New Deal. They called it the Green Apollo Project. The idea that it was going to be a jobs program and not just a, tree hugger climate thing, that was always a really central promise from liberals and Democrats who were concerned about how to make these transitions palatable to the public, right? So I'm sorry, I just had to interject that this is really a long time coming. So getting back to my question about all of these, two-thirds of the projects announced since it became law, so that's not two-thirds overall, are going to Republican-held congressional districts. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of different reasons. A couple of them, you know, number one, there are some red states or blue cities in red states or red communities that are just some of the faster growing parts of the country, right?
Yeah.
You look at parts of the South, you look at parts of the Sun Belt, that are either traditionally red, some are now blue that had recently been red, some are still purple, but you know, that's where population growth will happen more, you know, investment will naturally flow. Two, there's just great clean energy resources, frankly, in some of these communities, right? There's a reason that Iowa, Kansas, that Oklahoma, the South Dakota are leaders on wind energy. And some of it's been a policy leadership, right? The first state renewable portfolio standard in the country was actually embraced by a Republican governor in the 1980s in Iowa. But it's also because of the massive wind energy resource that exists there. And you're going to see that, like elsewhere, right? Rural communities, you're going to get a chance to see those sorts of investments, both in like these clean energy projects, but also in manufacturing facilities, right? Where companies can identify, site, build land at lower cost. The dollars are going to flow there too. And then there's just like the natural competition you've got between red states and blue states when it comes to siting and building and attracting companies, right? And some of that's a good story. Some of that's not always a good story. Where are taxes low? Where are labor standards low? Those sorts of things. It's as with many things, it's a complicated, nuanced answer as to why. But it is happening, and it's important to point out that so much of this investment is going into red communities, and that is ultimately going to result, I think, in the sort of transformation of the economic and geopolitical landscape that is going to be necessary for us to not just build clean energy projects, but to sustain a clean energy transition.
Yeah.
Right.
And it makes it does afford a degree of political protection with a change of control over Congress, et cetera, et cetera. These people are never going to embrace this policy publicly. I mean, Republican office holders, but when it's really down to businesses in their districts, that is it's a defense. It's a defense mechanism to set things up that way. Let's talk about consumer facing subsidies. I recently installed mini splits. These are cold weather heat pumps. They're awesome, right? Was not cheap, by the way, but my electrical utility gave me a huge rebate and my electric bills have dropped by about a third. How significant a piece of the puzzle can transitioning to heat pumps be? Because this seems to be like a buzzy thing. Everybody's talking, oh, let's do heat pumps and heat pumps. How significant is that? And do we know how much subsidies are going to be available and when? Are they already online?
There are. So first of all, this is a big deal. This is a game changer. Right now, in many parts of the country, heating and cooling is done with gas appliances in homes and commercial buildings. And those, in addition to leading to climate pollution, those can be, those lead directly to indoor air pollution, nitrous oxides, VOCs that harm health. We've been seeing some reading about that with gas stoves, right?
Yeah.
Some of the long held academic work in this, which people have known about for a long time, is, hey, this is actually really just bad for you, especially, people who are vulnerable, children, elderly, but everybody shouldn't be burning fossil gas inside of their homes, especially in their kitchens. But it's also costly. Gas appliances are not very efficient appliances. And if we can get more folks onto heat pump technologies and heat and cool their homes, both the air in their homes and the water within their homes, with more efficient electric technology, these heat pumps, that actually will be a game changer. And yes, there are dollars available right now. There's actually a couple different ways to get dollars to transform your home. The most immediately available and currently available as of January 1 is tax credits, the 25C home energy tax credit that allows you to spend a couple thousand dollars towards a heat pump and then additional money in panel breaker, circuit breaker upgrades, other improvements to make to your home for efficiency and electrification. You can take advantage of those tax credits now, including for gas stoves, electric induction stoves that we talked about. And those things, those are transformations that you can use a federal tax credit that's currently available to take advantage of now and filing your next tax filing. There are also two new programs from the Department of Energy that are going to be implemented by states. And those programs are still in formulation. One is a rebate for home energy efficiency upgrades. The other is a rebate specifically for home electric appliance purchases, but they're both going to be available to homeowners and can both be used for this purpose as well. Those programs are probably going to come online in the next year or so, with funded with a combined $9 million between them. Just that will be another offering. You mentioned taking
$9 billion.
$9 billion. Yeah. Sorry. No problem. You mentioned taking advantage of a currently available utility rebate program. Those exist in many parts of the country. There's also this new tax credit. And then there's yet still more money coming through these federal rebate programs. So like a lot of good incentive, a lot of good subsidy here for everyone to be able to take advantage of buying a new, more efficient, more cost-effective, and less polluting appliances for their homes.
Yeah. So some of those rebates are coming through the states, and it will probably vary by whether you live in a green or a blue or a red state.
Yeah, I mean, I am expecting, unlike some of these other programs, and you mentioned this, like, you know, some folks are going to maybe talk a lot about taking advantage of these programs, but like state energy offices, state agencies also want to provide their people with things, and they're under demands to provide their people with readily available of subsidies. And so I expect you're going to see most states, the vast majority of states, red, blue, and purple alike, take advantage of setting up these programs and doling these rebates out for folks to be able to electrify and cut costs in their homes.
So that would be not something that you file a tax. That's not a deduction on your taxes. These rebates you're talking about would come off of the retail sale. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I mean, they come off the retail sale, or they come off of the contractor work.
Right.
But they are more directly available, and states are going to get a chance to set these up directly, so they can structure them to flow through contractors. They can structure them to flow through, you know, the appliance retailers. Yeah. But that's all going to be part of the policy design.
And you think that'll come online the next year?
Yeah, I think that you're going to see rules come. The Department of Energy just last week issued a request for information. So they're looking for input as they construct these program, as they construct the rules of the road by which states have to apply to them for these programs. You're going to see states doing that. You're going to see states probably taking 2023 to build these programs and rolling them out, God willing, in 2024.
You know, this is the nice thing about having a podcast, because I've been curious about some of these things for myself. I get an expert on.
You
know,
you need, I've had fits and starts in replacing some appliances. Some broke, some didn't work. Even just finding a replacement with supply chains was challenging at times. So like, don't get me wrong. I spend my professional career working on advocating for, and now helping on implementation of these programs. I also need to keep track of these things for my own home.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
My wife is still, you know, anyways, it's all happening out there for us as humans, as well as us as professionals.
So, the Fox News perpetual outrage machine has a lot of conservatives vowing that you'll have to pry their gas stoves from their cold, dead hands. Sam, let's just have a fact check on this. Nobody is coming for your gas stove that already exists in your home, right?
Nobody is coming for your gas stove.
I live in New York, and they are actually considering a gas stove ban. It would apply only to new construction and not ban anyone's current gas stove. And they would phase that in. I believe that those mandates would kick in by like 2030. That's not a federal program. Again, nobody is contemplating taking gas stoves out of your home. But, and this is the real story, and I guess this gets back to the kind of communication gap that I mentioned up front. This is awesome. You can get a significant rebate sometime in the next year on an induction stove under the IRA. Chefs love them. They offer much more precise temperature control. Like, I'm an amateur cook. I like to cook. They heat up much more quickly than gas or electric stoves, and they won't give your kids asthma. So this is a really positive story. There's no jackboots involved, but you're going to have a significant rebate coming in the next year or so. And they'll just take that off of, I presume, off of your retail costs for that. I understand you mentioned this. You can also get up to several thousand dollars to upgrade your electrical breakers or whatever, if that's necessary to upgrade. What about if someone wants to transition to an EV? There are a bunch of new ones that are coming on the market, or that are already on the market, including a bunch at a lower price point. How much help could someone get to buy one of those?
Yeah, no. Good question. But real quick, also, you mentioned state policies. You know, the two states have actually embraced the requirement for all electric new appliances, no more gas appliances in two different ways. One, California, the Air Resources Board there has advanced a rule to require zero emission appliances, so not polluting gas appliances, both for heat pumps and for furnaces, and then ultimately like induction stoves. That'll be taking effect by 2030. Washington State Governor Inslee, where I'm from, has embraced in building codes. So for all new construction for both residential and commercial buildings, beginning later this year and next year, a requirement for zero emission appliances to be installed. So like, you know, lawmakers at the state and local level have been realizing this. And in many cases, and in large respects, they've been outpacing the discussion in Washington, D.C. and at the national level. And they're moving forward to ensure that healthier homes are being built and buildings are being built to employ Americans and their families.
And New York has to do a little bit more implementation, but they are moving ahead with a very similar program.
Yep, totally. So states are moving. Doubling back to your question, yes. So in addition to the incentives available for electrifying, cleaning up your household or your business building, also dollars are available up to $7,500 for towards purchase of an electric vehicle. These incentives are going to be available both in purchase of a new car, also in leasing a vehicle. And then for the first time, there's a $4,000 tax credit available for the purchase of a used electric vehicle, which is intended, you know, obviously to be more accessible because many people buy used vehicles, they're not brand new ones, but also to spark that secondary market for used vehicles, which is so important to bringing vehicles onto the plane. Electric vehicles, great news about them. Again, several things, several fold. One, it's cheaper to drive them because you don't need to fill up at the pump. Two, you're not driving around polluting your community. And three, you're going to cut climate pollution that's driving this climate change as well. And so, and these cars, man, they're taking off like rockets. First of all, if you've ever driven one, they're lots of fun to drive. The torque in these things, they go zoom. Right. And then two, you're seeing automakers recognize this is where people want to go. This is what people want to drive now. And this isn't a curve that's driving itself linearly. This is an exponential curve. You're seeing we were at, 2% of new car sales a couple of years ago, electric vehicles. We're like getting into the double digits here already in just a year or two. And we've got to move fast because we've got to get, polluting vehicles off the road. Vehicles, cars, trucks, are the most polluting part of the most climate polluting sector of the U.S. economy, which is transportation, right? Planes, trains, automobiles. And, we've got to transition those away from polluting resources to zero emission technologies. And so we got to build more of those cars here in the United States. We're doing that with some of those investments I mentioned at the top of the pod here, but also, we're making these more available to consumers with these massive federal tax incentives.
Folks, if you want just one more argument, let me quote, dogs prefer riding in electric cars over traditional combustion engine vehicles, according to new research by the Veterinary Behavioral Medicine Division at the University of Lincoln. So
that is a phenomenal, that is some phenomenal empirical evidence. I had not heard that before. Thank you for sharing.
I will send that over to you. All right, Sam, before I let you go, there's so much here. We can't cover it all. Is there a good source of information, of details for listeners who might want to take advantage of some of these dollars that are coming down the pike?
Yes, indeed there is. If you go to evergreenaction.com and click over to into the blog and the policy hub there, we've got materials on what's available in the Inflation Reduction Act, both when it comes to consumer incentives, but also when it comes to what state and local leaders can do to best take advantage of these dollars for their communities. Other groups out there, if you go to cleanenergy.gov, the administration has published a website that's probably going to be most helpful in understanding these resources. And there are others out there as well. The one other I mentioned is Rewiring America, rewiringamerica.org or .com has also got a calculator by which you can actually identify what subsidies are available here for heat pumps, induction stoves,
awesome,
the like, with your vehicles, and how much that might be able to save you based on your region of the country when it comes to your energy costs. So lots of tools that are out there. To your good point at the top of the show, we don't talk enough about this. We don't get enough of this out there. Lots of media infrastructural reasons for that. But the best anecdote is just, going around talking about it and sharing resources like this. So I appreciate the opportunity just to get on and talk with you about it.
Sam Ricketts, I really do appreciate you taking the time. I believe we are out of time. Really want to thank you for offering your insights.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Ross Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. At this point, you can follow me on Mastodon, I think. That's the place. At Joshua Holland. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you good folks for tuning in. Have a terrific week. The less we say about it, the better. Let's make it up as we go along.